Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, Democrats wrapped up their national convention last night in Charlotte with President Barack Obama accepting his nomination for re-election. The night before, former President Bill Clinton delivered a soaring speech that drew praise, even from some Republicans, although they disagreed with his message. Joining us here in the studio to talk about the convention and Kentucky's participation in it are WFPL political editor Philip Bailey, Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, and on the phone on his way back from Charlotte is Ryan Alessi, the senior managing editor and host of Pure Politics on CN2. Welcome back, everyone.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, Ryan, where are you this hour?
Well, we decided to hang around until after Byline was over, so we're actually still in Charlotte.
All right. Well, thanks for sticking around for us. Let me start with you. You were in the hall last night as the president delivered his speech. It appeared to be well received there. What was your take on it?
Well, it was really well received among the delegates there, but actually, it was some of the other speeches that I think really pumped people up in preparation for the president. Jennifer Granholm, the former governor from Michigan, really got the crowd on their feet, jumping up and down. I don't know how that played on TV, but in the hall, you couldn't even hear her last few lines because people were just cheering so loud.
Yeah, I watched a video of that online this morning. She was really fired up. I think one website called it a meltdown, but I think that's probably a little dramatic. But she really had the crowd fired up, talking about, I think, the number of jobs that were, in her estimation, saved by the auto industry bailout.
Yeah, she didn't mention Kentucky in all the states that she ticked off, but she was listing all the other states and how many jobs were saved or created because of the auto bailout. So, like I said, that's the thing. I don't know. This stuff plays so differently on TV than it does in the hall. For instance, last week I think it was much better received in Tampa in the convention center, or in the arena rather, Clint Eastwood's skit, mm-hmm. than it was on television, because I saw that later. So it's a very different feel from what is seen on TV. But the delegates, you know, there were a couple speeches that the delegates just ate up last night. John Kerry's was another. He had one line after one line. I don't know where that version of John Kerry came from, but certainly different from the one from 2004.
Yeah, I saw that. One of those zingers he had was ask Osama bin Laden if he's better off now than he was 4 years ago.
Right. And then Mitt Romney's version of a trip overseas was to trip all over himself while overseas.
Well, Kenny Colston here in the studio with us, along with WFPL's Philip Bailey. Kenny, more than 40% of Kentuckians voted for uncommitted in the primary over President Obama. Nearly all of the state's delegates pledged their support for the president at the convention this week. I mean, does it appear that they're ignoring the will of Democrats in Kentucky?
I'm sure some people will say that. And Congressman John Yarmuth, who was originally an unpledged delegate, when I talked to him, he said that he kind of expects some people might be upset with him because, you know, 42% of Democratic primary voters did not vote for the president in the primary. That being said, the congressman said basically, listen, there's no one else to vote for, and President Barack Obama is our candidate, is our nominee. That's who we're going to support. So basically, why wouldn't our delegates go ahead and kind of unify and try to support him? The only delegate that obviously wasn't there to do that was Congressman Ben Chandler, who did not show up at the convention at all. Apparently, there's no proxy to vote that delegate. Vote for the president. So basically 72 of Kentucky's 73 votes went to the president. That includes Governor Steve Beshear, all elected officials, everyone else basically said, you know, we want Barack Obama to be president again in a few years.
And we didn't see any Kentuckians, at the speaker's podium, unlike the Republican National Convention, where there were several.
Yeah, no, they basically stayed off stage. You know, you didn't. Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell, Andy Barr all got speeches down in Tampa. No Kentuckians took up the big DNC stage. But they basically made the case that they were working behind the scenes. Adam Edelin said that he had a few speeches with other delegations, including South Carolina, which is, you know, in demand because of its role in presidential politics, being one of the first couple states to vote. But basically, they were working behind the scenes. They were doing what they could. Of course, Matthew Barzin is the chief fundraiser for President Barack Obama. He's a native Kentuckian as well, so he's in a high-profile role. They basically just kind of kept to the sidelines and did what they could, according to the auditor, Adam Edelin.
Philip M. Bailey is here with us. Philip, you spoke with Senator Rand Paul earlier about the electoral map moving ahead. And what do you have to say?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at these conventions and the poll numbers, everyone is sort of focused on that, the theater of the conventions and what the popular vote might be. One way or the other, it shows pretty much a statistical tie. But when I talked to Senator Rand Paul, I mean, he and I talked about the electoral map. You know, the Electoral College is what votes for the president at the end of the day. And Senator Paul said that he was pretty concerned that it's pretty much a Democratic map, that the handful of states that are toss-ups, Governor Romney will have to win pretty much all of those, that you know, Republican candidates are not competitive in the West Coast or New England, and that those what we would consider swing states appear to be leaning towards Obama, and that it's very difficult for a Republican to overcome that. He suggested also that the idea of a more libertarian Republican candidate would be better situated, which I'm not sure if that means him in the future or what.
Ryan, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say the buzz around the convention center here in Charlotte was that a lot of those swing states, the ground game among the Democrats is way ahead of where the Republicans are, and they think they've got a lot of those locked down. Ohio is still the one that's kind of pivoting back and forth, but you know, they felt really good about Florida this week, so the Democrats are pretty pumped up, and you know, Kentuckians, I'm going to have a piece on tonight's show. Kentuckians, Kenny was right, really did play more of a supporting role. There were a couple of delegates who had produced their own bumper stickers, and so they were seeking out the swing state delegations to hand out these bumper stickers. You know, if you want to preserve Medicare, vote Democrat, Bin Laden is dead, GM is alive, those kind of things. And so that was kind of Kentuckians' role in the whole convention.
What was the level of enthusiasm among the Kentucky delegation, Ryan? President Obama has pretty much ignored the state, pretty much written it off. Are they excited?
Yeah, I mean, these delegates were all committed Democrats, and so most of them were really excited to be there, first of all. Second of all, they're really enthusiastic, even in areas where Barack Obama is not popular and lost to uncommitted. These delegates say they're going back there and they're going to try and convince their fellow Democrats why voting for Barack Obama is necessary, whether it's in the Bowling Green area because of the auto bailout, or whether it's in northern Kentucky convincing the Democrats up there that the health, the Affordable Care Act is something that will benefit most Kentuckians. They're kind of all taking these different talking points and themes. One of the big themes that the delegates really took away from it was the whole "we're in this together" theme, as opposed to what they say the Republicans are saying. It's every man for themselves, and I think we're going to hear a lot of that kind of trickle down into the state races this fall.
Did you, Ryan? Did you go to the convention in Tampa?
I did. I've been at both.
So, what are your thoughts as far as the presentation goes? Would you pick one over the other?
Well, the amazing thing is you'd think conventions are kind of similar formats, but they had completely different feels. The Republicans, it was very limited to that convention center and arena, and it was pretty much, you know, once you got in there, those were the extent of the activities. And in the Democrats, it was very much a community feel to it. The whole downtown of Charlotte was taken over. And so it's kind of interesting that the feel of the conventions was completely different. In terms of how the speeches went off, I thought the Republicans almost shied away from Mitt Romney too much. You know, the Democrats, they were all about Barack Obama. They made him the star. Everybody was talking about him. And the Republicans, there were a lot of those speeches that people have been talking about, Chris Christie, even Marco Rubio's, where it was very biographical about them, almost as if they're looking ahead to 2016 already. And I think that just kind of underscores that narrative Democrats have been pushing, that maybe Republicans aren't fully enthusiastic the way they need to be behind Mitt Romney in order to defeat an incumbent president.
Kenny Colston, what do you see happening here in the state as far as participation in the presidential campaigns on both sides?
You know, it's going to be kind of interesting. As we've talked about, I don't think Democrats really have any illusions about what the president can do. But that being said, you might still see high turnout because Democrats obviously want to hold on to the state house. So on a local level, they're going to push for voter turnout there. And the two Democratic congressmen, John Yarmuth and Ben Chandler, both are going up for re-election. So I think you'll see a lot of voter turnout, which could actually help Barack Obama maybe beat expectations. At the same time, Republicans, I don't know that Republicans in Kentucky are really excited about Mitt Romney. There was a lot of votes for people other than him in the primary, despite him not really having opposition. Barack Obama actually still got more votes than Mitt Romney in the primary. Of course, there is a registration advantage for Democrats in Kentucky. But, of course, they're gunning for the state house in the 6th District. They want to unseat Congressman Ben Chandler. So it's probably going to be a turnout game. The bad thing is that the last couple of elections in Kentucky, turnout's been horrible. So, you know, without throwing a prediction out there, that's the two narratives. You know, there's going to be turnouts to hold on to these seats, but at the same time, voters in Kentucky really seemed kind of electorally drained.
Philip, you think we'll see any visits, at least in this region, from either of the candidates?
Not really. I think at this point what we've seen is Kentucky is pretty much being used as a fundraising well, more than anything else. Electorally speaking, the border with Ohio, you see a lot of the Obama campaign folks volunteering there. Indiana appears is going to go back to red this election cycle, back to Romney. And as Ryan pointed out, I mean, there is still, with anytime you have someone challenging an incumbent president, there is the feeling that what if he does lose? So you have a lot of Republicans who honestly are thinking in the back of their minds, well, if this election doesn't go as we predict, as we want, what do we do in 2016? Who's the sort of candidate we do run? Is it a Jeb Bush? Is it a Rand Paul? Is it a Marco Rubio? So there are a lot of unanswered questions still, but Kentucky, for the most part, is out of the presidential game. And until both of these parties sort of shift, perhaps, and who they run as candidates, maybe ideologically, or the parties here begin to shift more to their national brethren, I think at this point Kentucky is going to be on the sidelines, and we're going to see sort of the trickle down of that from state house races or congressional races, maybe even looking forward to some of the Senate races we have coming up. But this year, I think Kentucky will see really just be a fundraising well more than anything else.
What do you think, Ryan? You sensing much enthusiasm on either side among Kentuckians to really get to work here in the last 2 months?
I think it'll pick up as the election gets closer, even though we're not going to see any of the ads that all these swing states are seeing. I think that actually might be an advantage. The swing state voters were telling the joke about how, you know, little kids there, when they see the president, and one of the people asked the kid, hey, what do you know who that guy is? And the kid's answer was, yeah, that's the guy who approves this message. They're sick of it, but I think the enthusiasm on both sides will pick up. I think a lot of the delegates from both parties are volunteering in Ohio. There's Republicans. Lewis Kelly, the son of former Senate Majority Leader Dan Kelly, he's been organizing groups every weekend out of northern Kentucky to work door-to-door in the Cincinnati area. Democrats are doing the same thing out of their Louisville Obama campaign headquarters. So I think that'll pick up, and it's a presidential year. You won't be able to escape it on the news. So I think turnout will be well over 50%, if not over 60% again.
All right, Ryan Alessi in Charlotte, Kenny Colston, Philip M. Bailey. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, the federal health care law pushed by President Obama, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear announced that Kentucky would move ahead with the creation of a state health insurance exchange and, of course, be eligible for federal subsidies under the new law. So how will it work? We're here to try to answer that question as simply as possibly, we hope, our Julie Appleby, a senior correspondent for the nonprofit news service Kaiser Health News. That's a program of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. Her reporting focuses on health policy issues, including the federal health law. Julia has asked that we point out that Kaiser Health News is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente Healthcare and Health Insurance Company. And also joining us is Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Kenny Colston. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the basics. Julie, what is a health insurance exchange? What's it look like?
Well, you can think of it a little bit like, you know how you go online, you maybe you shop for a hotel or an airline ticket. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an online marketplace where people can go plug in a little bit of information about themselves, their age, where they live, how large their family size is, and get a sort of a menu of different options that are going to be available to them to purchase insurance. So the number of different insurers, number of different plans that they can pick and choose from, all at presumably different price points. The exchanges aren't going to open until the end of next year, when people can start to shop, and then actual coverage would kick off in 2014. So there's still a little bit away, but it's kind of like that. You're kind of like shopping for an airline ticket online. You plug in your information and some choices pop up. The key thing with this, though, is it's also going to be the place where people go to get their subsidies if they qualify for some federal government help in purchasing insurance. And remember, those sliding scale subsidies go up to about 400% of the federal poverty level, which this year is about $44,000 for an individual. And it's also where people would find out if they qualify for the Medicaid program. So those are just some of the elements that are involved with these exchanges.
Now, do we have a permanent number now on how many states are actually going to have exchanges and how many are not?
You know, this has gotten very political. A lot of governors and a lot of states are moving forward. A lot of governors said that they wanted to wait and see what happened with the Supreme Court decision, and some are even now waiting until they see what happens in the November election. There are about 15 states that are moving forward with either legislation or some kind of executive order that are setting up these exchanges. Another 7 states have said they're not going to do it at all, and the rest, we're kind of waiting to hear what they say. The states have until about November 16th to tell the federal government, hey, here's our blueprint for moving forward. We're either going to run our own exchange or we're not. And for those states that don't, the federal government is going to run an exchange for them. States can also decide to sort of partner with the federal government. So the state might run part of the exchange and the federal government might run the other part.
Now, will they be penalized if they don't initiate and put in their exchange?
No, I don't think there's a formal penalty, but the question is, you know, a lot of states want to run these things themselves because the states can then set more of the rules. The law gives states quite a bit of flexibility to decide how they want to run these exchanges. For example, do they want to take every single insurer that meets the minimum benefit, you know, that creates a minimum benefit package that meets the qualifications? Do you want to take them all, or do they want to be a little more selective and say, well, in addition to meeting these requirements, we also want you to meet some quality or value or price kind of things and limit how many insurers are going to be there? So that would be a state decision that they wouldn't be able to make if they were letting the feds run their exchange for them.
I see. Kenny Colston, where are we here in Kentucky? What's the next step as far as our exchange goes?
Kentucky's next step is to pick what's called basically a model plan. Kentucky has obviously decided they're going to run their own health benefit exchange. And they've already set up an office. They have an executive director. They're looking at cost and building the infrastructure. But like we've heard, you know, that they still have a little bit of time. But the next big deadline that they have to meet is by the end of this month, they have to pick what's called a model plan. And, you know, it can get really tough. But, you know, to think, well, what's a model plan? Do they have to create it out of nothing? Do they have to create it out of something? And the answer is they do have to create it out of something. It has to cover certain things: ambulance service, emergency services, maternity, substance abuse, rehab, preventive care, chronic disease management. We could go on and on and on. But basically from there, they have 10 to 12 places they can pick from. Largest state employee, which not a lot, unless you're a state employee, you know, that's not, you don't really know what's in those. But what's probably most likely to happen is there's called what's called small group plans. And if the state doesn't pick one of these other plans, the federal government says they'll choose one of the small group plans. And this is probably what people are most familiar with, because you're looking at Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, which a lot of people in Kentucky have, they know about. Their HMO plan, they could pick that as their model plan. They could pick Anthem's so-called Luminos plan, which is a health savings account. A lot of employers here in Louisville use that type plan. Or the other thing they could use is what's called a point of service plan from United Healthcare. And I think that's actually a plan that a lot of University of Louisville students are offered if they don't get their own health insurance. So it's not some far-fetched thing. These insurance plans that they're going to pick a model from, a lot of chances are that you already have them. Maybe the Humana Vitality Plan, which I know a lot of other places have, is their health insurance. So what's going to be on the exchange should be familiar to people here in Kentucky. It's going to be plans that are already offered when they pick their model plan.
If you have a plan and you're not particularly happy with it, can you go shopping here at this exchange?
Yeah, it's open to the public, obviously. There's also going to be kind of a portal for small businesses to tell their employees, hey, go ahead, go. This is where you're going to get your insurance from. We're going to use this exchange, so go ahead and get on there. It's basically like we've talked about it. It's going to be a marketplace. What that marketplace ends up looking like, I think, is still up for debate. Not all the rules are set, but in essence, I think the analogy that you're going to go on a place like Orbitz or Priceline or Kayak, places where you buy hotels and airlines, that's going to be a great deal. You know, substitute Delta for Humana, substitute United Healthcare for Southwest, and that's what it's going to be like.
And, I meant to check this before I came in, but in Indiana is also working on a plan of their own, I believe.
Yeah, as far as I know, but I don't believe they're as far along as Kentucky
right.
is.
Yeah, but they've been talking about it for quite a while. Well, Kentucky lawmakers haven't had their full say on this matter. That, of course, the court decision came down in June. It was well past when the session ended. So when do they get that?
Well, apparently they're not going to get one now. It came out late yesterday afternoon that legislative leaders were going to need to schedule a special meeting for the Health and Interim Health and Welfare Committee, and the legislative leaders did not approve that. So lawmakers, there's going to be a deadline that passes for them to officially record their say on the executive order that created the exchange, and that's going to pass. Their next meeting is after that deadline. So I'm sure we're going to continue to hear about it. It's going to come up in legislative meetings, but in terms of actually getting their own vote on the exchange and the executive order that set it up, apparently they're not going to get that.
And Julie Appleby, I'll pose the last question to you. Do you think this is going to make the insurance buying process easier?
Well, there's a couple things with that. Yes and no. It's still going to be complicated because you still have to work your way through four or five different types of plans. They're going to have a bronze, a silver, gold, and a platinum that have different coverage levels. So you are going to have to work that type of thing out. But bottom line is right now in the individuals who buy their own insurance, most of the people that are going to be using this marketplace, a lot of them are going to be individuals who buy their own insurance. In most states right now, you can be turned down for coverage by an insurer if you have a medical condition. The new law starting 2014 says they can no longer do that. So in some sense, that'll make it a little bit easier. You're not going to get rejected by an insurer, but you're still going to have to sort through varying deductibles and copayments and premiums and that type of thing. And these systems are supposed to set up a call center with some help for people to help work through this. They can obviously still go to an insurance broker and maybe ask some questions and that type of thing. So it is going to put it all in one place. There'll be some more apples to apples comparison, but people are still going to have to make choices.
Julie Appleby is with the Kaiser Health News, and Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston joined us to talk about the health exchange and make it simple. And I think you did a good job of that. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
This is Byline on WFPL. It's now estimated that 750,000 people, 2.5% of the population, died in the American Civil War from 1861 to 1865. A new documentary from filmmaker Rick Burns explores how the scale of the war's carnage forced Americans and woefully unprepared government officials to deal with death on a massive scale. The documentary is called Death and the Civil War. It premieres September 18th as part of the American Experience series on PBS. I caught up with Rick Burns this week. He spoke to us from his office in New York. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
It was really startling how unprepared the government was for the scale of carnage that took place during the Civil War.
It was literally unprecedented. I mean, last war we'd fought before the Civil War, the Mexican War, couple of years of combat, maybe 2,500 battlefield deaths. I mean, that was the kind of thing that would have been predicted. It was predicted that there would be almost no bloodshed, that neither side would have the stomach to fight. And if there was fighting, no one had any context for understanding how extraordinarily lethal it was going to become, and become very, very quickly. So there were no preparations for caring for the wounded and the dying and the dead, no provisions for burying them in any way at that number, no provisions for notifying next of kin. I mean, really at every level, from the most deeply personal to the most broadly governmental, there was simply no preparedness for this event. And like all events that are new and unprecedented, there was a tremendous, odd thing to think, generative power. I mean, people had to cope with new circumstances. And from individuals to groups and finally to larger states and the federal government itself, there's an enormous amount of improvisation that took place during the war as people struggled to figure out how to deal with this new reality.
And as usual, it took a group of women to help straighten things out.
It's stunning. You know, Clara Barton, you know, we have these names that kind of come up to us in history, as rightly they should. But it really was. I mean, from the beginning, you know, there's this patent clerk in the patent office in Washington, Clara Barton, who can see that Washington is just a tide of blood is washing, you know, up the Potomac. And there was no preparedness for it. And so she sets out to become kind of a one-woman, you know, ambulance corps. There was no ambulance corps. There was no, the United States government until 1864 had no ambulance corps for the Army of the Potomac, for any of its armies. So much of it was being done on a voluntary basis by people like Clara Barton, by the women and men who, you know, staffed the U.S. Sanitary Commission or the U.S. Christian Commissions. Those are all voluntary private organizations which are raising their own money and trying to help out. And in the South as well, where the circumstances were even worse, the resources were fewer on the ground, vastly less fewer economic means to do so. Again, primarily women's groups across the South doing what they could to care for the wounded and try to bury the dead. But, I mean, everyone was overwhelmed. Every system in place was overwhelmed. And that was really the experience during the war. And therefore, you had these horrific circumstances that not only were people dying by the hundreds of thousands, 750,000 now, in the new estimate that came out just last year, in a population of 30 million. We had a comparable death rate, you know, today, 2.5-3% of our 300 million Americans, that'd be 7 million people dead. I mean, staggering
unbelievable
rate of death.
One thing that really struck me was the soldiers came to realize that they weren't getting any help from the government. They came to prepare for what they called the good death.
That's right. I mean, America is a profoundly religious, profoundly Christian country on the eve of the Civil War. And even though you had a much higher chance of dying, especially in childhood or childbirth, in the middle 19th century, you could absolutely expect to die at home. That you would be surrounded by friends and family, and you know, who could see that you were ready to die, to meet your maker, and had some kind of, there was some kind of resolution. Now you're dying not at home in your own bed, surrounded by your family, but you're dying on a battlefield that might be 1,000 miles away with strangers. How do you die a good death? This profoundly important feature of American spiritual and psychic life in the mid-19th century. And so you had this tremendously moving fact that soldiers would, you know, make pacts with each other. I will contact your family, you contact mine in the event of a lethal outcome. Please send this home to my wife or my daughter or my sister or my mother. The extremely moving fictions, which a surgeon might, in a letter home to grieving parents, say, you know, I didn't know your son well. In fact, he was a stranger to me, but he seemed to me at peace with himself and his God. So that people did whatever they could to, in these worst of all circumstances, somehow create some semblance of a good death, even as people were dying all around them.
And the film is going to coincide, the air date coincide with the Battle of Antietam?
It does. It'll be broadcast on September 18th, the day after the 150th anniversary of Antietam, still the bloodiest, most lethal day in American history.
It's called Death in the Civil War, written and directed by Rick Burns. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
And once again, Death in the Civil War will premiere on September 18th as part of the American Experience series on PBS. This is Byline on WFPL. Natural gas is becoming increasingly popular as a source of electricity, and in many places, including Louisville, it's replacing coal. But natural gas is also becoming more prevalent as fuel for vehicles. WFPL's Erica Peterson reports.
Rain is pounding the garage at Waste Management's facility off of Fern Valley Road. Parked after its daily route is a garbage truck. And on one side, so large it's hard to miss, is a sign that says, "Think green, think clean." A reference to the fact that this truck burns cleaner natural gas. Mike Fuller is the senior district manager for Waste Management. He's showing off one of the 17 new natural gas-powered garbage trucks the company introduced in Louisville last month.
They burn much cleaner, not only from an air pollution, but from a noise pollution standpoint. You know, they're quiet. You still have the sound of the hydraulics, which you can't minimize. But as far as the engine itself, it is night and day difference. It amazed me the first time I ever heard one roll onto the lot how quiet it was.
Waste Management has around 90 trucks on the road in Louisville every day. By the end of this year, nearly half of those will be powered by compressed natural gas, or CNG. And the trend in Kentucky isn't limited to Waste Management, or even Louisville. CNG filling stations are planned across the state, in places like Somerset and Paducah. Earlier this summer, a company called Westport opened a facility to manufacture fuel systems for Ford trucks that can run on conventional gasoline or natural gas.
The natural gas market across Kentucky is mirroring what's happening across the nation.
Melissa Howell is the executive director of the Kentucky Clean Fuels Coalition. She says natural gas-powered vehicles were around in the 1990s, too. But a few things have changed since then. Namely, the industry discovered the vast reserves of gas in the Marcellus Shale. Howell says before that, people and companies interested in natural gas-powered vehicles generally couldn't just get one off the line from an automaker.
Now that is the case. We have a lot to choose from with respect to vehicles. We have an abundant supply of natural gas. We have retailers that are very interested in natural gas. It's about the economy, and it's about what works on the bottom line.
Howell says the issue with so-called alternative fuels, natural gas included, is that if there's nowhere to fill up, car manufacturers don't make vehicles that can use the new fuel. And if car companies aren't making vehicles, there's no incentive to build filling stations. But she says it's getting easier and easier to find a place to fill up a CNG vehicle, and that's partly because of the price.
There is definitely a niche in the transportation sector for natural gas. Specifically, heavy-duty fleets are ideal for natural gas. That business case can be made very quickly with respect to return on investment.
Waste Management built a public filling station on their property near the airport in Louisville. It's open 24 hours and looks pretty much like a regular gas pump, except for the price, $2.39 for the equivalent of a gallon of gasoline. For companies that use big, gas-guzzling vehicles, those cost savings can add up. But for private citizens, the upfront costs of buying a CNG vehicle may not make it worthwhile. And the fuel does burn cleaner than diesel, but the use of natural gas in vehicles has been criticized due to the environmental damage caused by fracturing shale rock, or fracking, to extract the gas. Howell says Kentucky isn't yet at a place where someone could buy a natural gas-powered vehicle and easily find a place to fill up. But there are several projects in the works, and she expects interest to grow, especially among companies with large fleets. Erica Peterson, WFPL News.
You can learn more about natural gas vehicles, and hear Erica's report again at WFPL.org. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Heldet. It's time to rebrand the Buck, so says Richard Smith, a creative strategy consultant who, as he puts it, specializes in transforming brands into wants and desires. He says the look and feel of the U.S. currency are stagnant and long overdue for a makeover. Independent radio producer Roman Mars has more in this story called The Color of Money.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. U.S. paper currency is so ubiquitous that to really look at its graphic design with fresh eyes requires deliberate and focused attention. So pull out a greenback from your wallet or look at a picture online if you're in another country and just really take it in. All the fonts, the busy filigree, the micro patterns. It's just dreadful.
From a pure designer's point of view, that's tough because it is a little bit subjective, but
it's horrible. There's like 8 fonts on this thing.
Typographically, graphically, symbolically, if it had never been designed before and someone was to submit that as a solution, I think they would just sort of throw it out.
And I don't want to get too critical at this point because there are actually pretty compelling and understandable reasons for its particular brand of horribleness. But I think the primary tension embodied in the design of the greenback boils down to how my friend Tom Nelson at the blog Humans in Design puts it.
When I handle American money, it feels like an artifact because it's so ornate and it has an old look to it.
Even though paper currency itself, just the idea of money, is a massive, world-changing technology, the look and feel of U.S. paper money is very stagnant. It seems like a relic from when our country was founded.
Would you buy a car that still looked like the Model T Ford? No, you buy the latest model of it. Things evolve and change with time.
That's Richard Smith. He runs a contest called the Dollar Redesign Project.
It's become a classic, like classics do, through time and through usage and through familiarity. So its awkwardness from a design point of view has kind of been superseded by its symbolicness.
So if you were to start from scratch and redesign U.S. paper money, Smith says there are five major areas where we could improve. Number one is color.
The idea of using one color doesn't really tell you much other than that we like the color green.
Our largely monochromatic money kind of baffles me. We've introduced a purple five and some peachy hues, but there are a lot of colors and most countries use at least some of them. Number two is size.
Well, why is the American currency all one size? It's always been a question mark in my head and just never really made sense practically and philosophically.
Having variable-sized coins certainly helps us sort them, and you could use the same principle for bills, which leads us to point number three in Smith's manifesto. Functionality.
Some functionality that enables people, if they can't see, to clearly distinguish on a very sort of fundamental level which note is which.
The fact that there's no easy way for the blind to use our currency goes beyond bad design and is actually immoral.
Then the next fundamental thing I thought was composition.
That's number four.
Meaning, like, what's it made from? This is a little sort of conceptual into, like, where this could go, but, you know, it just seems that a product designer could come in and sort of come up with something really interesting.
Recycled material with a smaller carbon footprint or more durable synthetics that last longer. And at the very heart of the Dollar Redesign Project is number five, symbolism.
Who should go on the bills and why? And, you know, why are the founding fathers the be-all and end-all of everything that is America? And I think for me, that's one of the biggest issues. If we were to change anything, I would say that would be where I would start. It could be a platform to celebrate everything that is unique, special, different, that you didn't know about America.
And that's the suggestion that can get a British expat on his way to American citizenship, like Richard Smith, some colorful hate mail. But it's an intriguing list nonetheless. Even if you just view the five suggestions as a philosophical exercise to assess the current design for all of its strengths and faults. It's hard to imagine all those things being modified on U.S. currency, but it's not hard to imagine each of them being implemented somewhere. In fact, most of them are implemented everywhere. Case in point, Australia. On the other side of the world, each and every one of these five issues have coincidentally been addressed.
Let me introduce a masterpiece of Australian design and technology. Australia's new $5 plastic note.
I'm really proud of our money. I have absolutely no idea why I'm so proud of it, but I really am.
That's Tristan Cook. And you're about to hear why he's so proud. Tristan and Tom Nelson, who you heard from briefly at the top of the show, are user-centered designers, and they run a blog that I'm a big fan of called Humans in Design. Tristan is Australian, Tom is American, but Tom went to school in Australia for a couple years, and the money there made a big impression on him.
The money is plastic, and they're all different sizes, and they're colorful.
At first, these changes were disconcerting.
It all just looked like toy money to me.
But after Tom's initial shock, he began to appreciate all the different design characteristics of Australian currency. First is the color.
$5 is sort of a lavender. $10 is blue with a little bit of a green stripe in it. $20 is...
When you look at the ways you can tell the differences between things, generally it's called coding. That's the very simple human factors term for it. And you code through things like size, shape, feel, and color. So in Australian money, we have ours coded primarily by color.
Which in some ways is a better index because it doesn't require knowledge of who's on the bill. It only requires recognition of a color.
Or an association with a pineapple or a lobster.
It's not very common just yet, but we call our notes colloquial names by their colors. And my two personal favorites are calling the $20 note, which is sort of an orange color, calling it a lobster, and calling the $50 note, which is a sort of a green and yellow color, and calling it a piney, which is short for a pineapple.
It's all about the pineys. Number two, size.
The bills are also different sizes as well, so they feel different in your hand.
sometimes when I've got a bit of cash in my pocket, I can tell the difference between a $5 note and a $20 note because of the feel.
I would say that it's about a centimeter difference between each denomination, which between a 5 and a 10 isn't that big, but between a 5 and a 50 is very big. So you get like 4 centimeters difference.
Both number 1 and 2 relate to the third issue raised by Richard Smith, and that's functionality.
You can see whether you've got a 5, a 10, a 20, or a 50 from the top of your wallet.
Because of the color and size differences. Number 4, composition.
It's a thin sheet of plastic.
The Palmer notes were developed primarily to combat counterfeiting.
Feels like plastic that you can fold and scrunch up. You can actually put it through the washing machine and it'll be fine.
If you drop a note on the floor of a men's room, you don't really feel bad about picking it up and putting it under the faucet before you put it back in your pocket. These plastic notes cost more, but they last longer.
They tend to last 4 times longer than fibrous paper notes.
So you get notes in Australia that are 20 years old and they pretty much just look the same.
What Australia chooses to put on its currency is more in keeping with what Richard Smith of the Dollar Redesign Project would like to see. It's much more inclusive than founding fathers and monuments. But it's hard to tell if these symbols are conveying much of anything to everyday Australians.
They don't put statesmen on money frequently. There are artists and poets and there are some Aboriginal leaders.
That's another thing, too. You could not put prime ministers on our money. We don't have the reverence for prime ministers in Australia.
But most Australians couldn't name the people that are on their money.
I have absolutely no idea who is on any of our notes, except for one side of the $5 note is the Queen, and that's just because I don't want her on there. I'd imagine if you asked any Australian if they know who is on their notes, there would be less than 1% of people who could name anybody other than the Queen.
The symbolism in Australian cash seems to be tied more to the innovation of the bills themselves. There's a certain pride that polymer bills were developed in Australia and have been exported to the rest of the world. Australia now manufactures the polymer notes of nearly 20 other countries.
It's a good business for them.
The good design of the currency itself is the overriding brand.
It's no ordinary note, however. It's Australia's new polymer $10 note. And it was developed and printed right here.
I would like to see American currency redesigned and treated more like a living piece of technology rather than an artifact.
I think even the most jingoistic among us could concede that there are design innovations that could be incorporated into U.S. currency to make it better, but there are some interesting reasons why we probably won't.
You know, someone once told me that getting rid of the greenback would be like burning the flag on the steps of the Capitol.
That's David Woolman.
My name is David Woolman. My book is The End of Money.
For a lot of people, our currency is a physical touchstone of our national identity.
Some of this is emotional, but there is this other concern that is simultaneously tantalizing and scary, I think.
And that other concern is that when you redesign the money, you remind people what currency is and what gives the currency value.
And of course, what gives the currency value is our belief that it's valuable. And in the religious sense of it, nothing more than faith or trust or worship, whatever you want to call it, makes a dollar worth a dollar or worth whatever you're going to buy with it. So that is upsetting to a lot of people. And to maintain the aura of strength and stability of the United States economy,
it probably helps to maintain these legacy features in the design of our money.
Through what is now 3 or 4 generations. We've had the same color, I think, since like the Civil War.
The portraits, the engraved styling, the filigree, the legacy features convey stability. And our currency, the currency on which all other currencies are hitched, has to be stable.
So not only do we not redesign the stuff, but we don't pull older notes from circulation either. So we'll have reissues and redesigns of our cash, but you can still use the last generation design as legal tender.
In other countries, a complete redesign deprecates the old design. You're given a grace period to use or exchange it, but after a certain date, the old currency is shredded by the central bank, and you can no longer spend any that you have left. This has never been the case in the U.S.
You can even use an 18th century coin stamped with just the value of 2 cents to go buy something. You might want to be careful because that could be so stupid. It could be worth $3,000 to a collector out there. But if you want to go spend it as 2 cents, you can. And again, this is part of creating this aura of super stability and inherent value of Federal Reserve notes.
David Woolman is quick to point out that even though these concerns of instability have been cited when people bring up redesigning the money or eliminating the penny, he thinks it's pretty irrational and an overly cautious stance.
It seems to me a little bit patronizing to think that Americans couldn't handle a dollar redesign.
But really, who is going to push it forward?
You know, if you're going to go to work in government, don't you almost by definition have some of that sense of patriotism and nationalism that would make you a little bit more inclined to like the greenback as is and a little less inclined to let some RISD hotshots get after it.
Fair enough.
But still, primarily driven by anti-counterfeiting measures, U.S. currency has been pushed to change in recent years. And most of these new designs are why it looks worse than ever. The legacy features remain largely intact, but a layer of modern fonts and swirls makes the bills look like they're busting at the seams. It's the worst of both worlds.
You know, it's absolute chaos. There's very little that's elegant about our money from a design standpoint, as far as I understand it.
When I told David Woolman about my newfound discovery and appreciation of the Australian dollar as evangelized by Tristan and Tom, he was less than impressed.
I don't think it's that remarkable. Congratulations to the Aussies and the scientists who came up with polymer banknotes. And I think they profited well because of that innovation. But I'm just not convinced it's a very world-changing kind of thing. It's pretty.
Hey, I personally think pretty counts. But from his point of view, a better designed banknote, even a plastic one, is still just a piece of paper. I mean, his book is called The End of Money, after all.
The design efforts out there related to money that excite me more are the design for the user interface of apps for mobile money, right? How are we going to be transacting with money in PayPal Mobile and Google Wallet? And what are designers bringing to bear on those interfaces? Because the interface with paper or polymer money, I get it already. And the truly interesting frontier of design is not going to be the banknote art that the Swiss come up with in 2016, right? It's going to be the interface with mobile apps and what designers are doing to make our interactions with money more fluid, more sophisticated, and possibly, God forbid, even like wiser. You know, who's designing the apps to make us a little more careful with our money, and how are they bringing to bear sort of the principles of design to make that happen?
And this is something that Tristan and Tom are totally on board with. Physical money is probably on its way out, and polymer money, as cool as it is a technology of its time. They themselves have actually designed clever user interfaces so that the good aspects of physical money are retained, and transactions feel more tangible and more real, even when it's just bits flying through the air. So the physical US $20 bill will probably be gone from widespread use before it's a lovely shade of orangey red. I'm okay with that. Just as long as I don't have to see that wavy Six Flag amusement park font that says 20 USA in the background. I mean, seriously, what the hell were they thinking? That font is even cruel to Andrew Jackson, and that guy was a jerk. "99% Invisible was produced this week by me, Roman Mars, with special thanks to Tristan Cook and Tom Nelson of the blog Humans in Design. We'll have a link on the website. We are a project of KALW 91.7 Local Public Radio in San Francisco and the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco. We are distributed by PRX, the public radio exchange, making public radio more public. More at prx.org. This is just a reminder that every episode of 99% Invisible is available to be downloaded for your listening pleasure, and each one is better than the last, whether you're going backwards or forwards. It is amazing and impossible, but yet, it is still true. You can find the show and like the show and interact with me on Facebook. I tweet and often tweet back to people at Roman Mars. But this week, you will find pretty pictures of plastic bills at 99%invisible.org.
And the piece you just heard, The Color of Money, was produced by independent radio producer Roman Mars. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information on today's Byline topics, or to hear the show again, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Heldick. Have a great weekend.